Hi, everyone. My name's Jane, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm so happy to be here this morning and to see all these smiling faces. And I love the name of the actual convention. The theme is miracles. And, you know, just looking out at this audience right now, I bet every single one of us is a miracle. I bet you, you know, every single one of us probably shouldn't be here right now. I know I certainly shouldn't be here. So I get very moved when I look out and I see all these saved souls as a result of this wonderful program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And because it's Sunday morning, and usually there's a spiritual bent to the Sunday morning speaker's responsibilities, I just wanted to acknowledge God's grace and invite grace into the room right now. You know, I can't help but think about God's grace at conventions like this, at roundups like this, because it's all over the place. You know, and it's here right now. I feel it. And that's the cool thing about grace. It has nothing to do with anything that we've done or we haven't done. It's just there for the taking all the time. It's just up to us to screw into it. And I certainly feel like grace is ever present with me. It's sort of like this cool undercurrent that's always flowing through life, and it offers beautiful things such as light and love and forgiveness and illumination. And at moments like this too, I feel like the will of God will never take me where the grace of God won't protect me. And I have to admit, I'm very nervous right now. I always get nervous, but my sponsor tells me that that's a good thing because it means that I'm humble enough to let God in. And that's what I do before I do my talks. I ask to be emptied out and for the Holy Spirit to fill me up. I also want to thank the committee for all the hard work that goes into putting these affairs together. Bill, I want to thank you for inviting me and for picking me up at the airport. Candy, for the lovely, lovely gift box that was waiting for me in my room to greet me. It was just put together with such love. Even the gestures like that are very moving. I also want to thank my lovely hostess, Michelle, who I've loved getting to know this weekend. And how about the speakers this weekend? Have they rocked or what? You know, I mean, starting out, you know, what a great start with my friend Bobby, who is actually, this is kind of a small world story, but she's from Tallahassee too and goes to my home group as well. So I haven't really spent that much time with Bobby. I always am warmed by her lovely smile and we always, you know, say hello and hug, but we've never really gotten to know each other. So I feel like this might be the beginning of a really new and beautiful friendship, thanks to this convention bringing us together. And I also want to thank Corey. You know, there was something that really moved me about your talk yesterday. So much of what you said resonated with me. And, you know, we have so many similarities. I think I'm like an Al-Anonic alcoholic or something, because I have so many of those qualities, too. And Doug, last night was just unbelievable. And, you know, what an example of somebody who has been through so much so late, you know, so recently, but is brave enough and courageous enough to bear his soul to a group of, you know, strangers really, but actually friends. But to do so with such dignity and grace last night was just also so heartwarming. So I feel like I feel like I have to live up to some pretty high expectations being the final speaker, but anyway, I promise you, you know, I'll do the best that I can, but God's got it. And I also really like to, you know, quiet my soul, quiet my mind, and I would ask for you to do the same with me right now and close your eyes and please join me in saying the third step prayer. God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, so that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. You know, from the other speakers, we've heard that sometimes our dark pasts really are the greatest possessions that we have. And I know that that doesn't go with just only the speakers. It goes with probably everybody sitting in this room. You know, and I remain so grateful that my heart remains open. It hasn't hardened. My heart is still very soft. And so I can receive things. I can continue to receive things. I really feel that one of the, and again, miracles of this program is that each day, as Bobby said Friday night, somewhere in this world, every day, one alcoholic tells his or her story to another alcoholic. And God speaks to us all differently, but I know that God wants us to share our stories. And in so doing, we share our experience, our strength, and our hope. God promises a safe landing, but he doesn't promise us a calm passage. And that's what I'm about to do, is tell you about my not-so-calm passage to what led me here today. I have to say that I am on fire with this gift of sobriety, this life-giving, this life-sustaining gift of sobriety. I'm always grateful. I never take it for granted. And I'm so happy to stand before you today as a humble servant of Alcoholics Anonymous who's been asked to share my story with you. My home group is 909 Central Group, Tallahassee, Florida. I've been sober since September 24th, 1996. That is truly a miracle. I really, as I said, I should not be here. And I have a wonderful sponsor. His name is Diz. He's an old timer in Tallahassee. And, you know, he's very ill right now. And I guess I just want to give him a shout out for what a friend, what a tremendous support he's been through my whole life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think there's anybody that I know that knows the big book better than Diz. And that's really what I wanted in a sponsor. And, you know, when I have girl problems or relationship problems, I have my friends in AA to turn to discuss. But I'll give him, like, the problem in a nutshell, and he'll tell me exactly what page to go to. You know, he doesn't want to hear all the dirt, but I'm so, so grateful that he's in my life. And I've had wonderful sponsors. I've had wonderful sponsees. I have a tremendous faith in my God and a wonderful support system in my family. And those are some of the very few gifts of sobriety that I've received since becoming sober back in 1996. Well, I'll begin my story by talking about the day I was born, November 20th, 1962. I'll save you the math. I'm 51 years old, and I'm a very happily unmarried woman. I've never been married. I've actually never lived with anybody either. And I have no kids, but I think I'm the cool aunt. I have a lot of nieces and nephews, and I am in a new relationship, a new wonderful relationship, but I certainly have had my fair share of long-term relationships. But I really want to tell you that I was born with a silver spoon in my mouth. I was raised in an Irish Catholic family. I mean, the blood that courses through my veins is 100% Irish. Yay, Garrett! Which I think predisposes me to the disease of alcoholism. But neither my mother nor father drank. I mean, my father would get buzzed at, you know, family weddings and stuff, but I never saw my mother take a drink. There are five kids in my family. I'm the second oldest. I'm the oldest girl. And I can't tell you how fortunate I was growing up. And that's one of the things that I think is great about weekends like this, because we get it on the whole spectrum. Like, sometimes I feel survivor's guilt when I hear stories like Bobby's, how, you know, she came from a difficult childhood, but look at the beautiful woman that she is today. And I, on the other hand, like, came from a family like Doug's. I was raised with love and nurturance. My parents only told me how wonderful and beautiful and how smart I was. They sent us to the best of schools. you know, I grew up and I went to all Catholic schools. I went to a Catholic elementary school where I think as a youth I was pretty gregarious, I was mischievous, but I was really a good girl, you know. And I moved on, I went to an all-girl Catholic high school, and I actually, it was very small and very exclusive, and I graduated in 1981, and there were only 81 girls in my class at that time. And one of my classmates was Whitney Houston, who was also very, you know, just the all-American girl, just like I was, had a great youth, grew up to be, you know, just a typical, normal, all-American girl in high school. And then, you know, look at her demise. It's one of the saddest stories that I've ever heard. And she's not with us today because of the disease of alcoholism, the disease of addiction. But in high school, I was the all-American girl. You know, I was on the student council. I was on the, you know, track team, ski team. I mean, I did everything that a normal, healthy high school girl would do. I have to say that high school, however, was when I started to show a little bit of rebellion. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. Her whole life was dedicated to taking care of her husband and her children. And my dad, I'm very proud of my dad. He was a track coach, but also, back in the day, a world-class runner. As a matter of fact, he was favored to be the first ever to break the 4-minute mile. And he went on, he didn't do it, he missed it by something like 0.008 of a second. But for this skinny little white kid from East Orange, New Jersey, to be a world champion runner really showed his drive, his sense of discipline, and it, sometimes it was like growing up with a military dad, to tell you the truth. He was very, very disciplined. He felt old school, like his job was to bring home the bread and butter. My mother was the one who was to, you know, nurture the kids and stuff. And then he went on to coach college, because when he was coaching high school, one of his runners broke the 4-minute mile, was the first ever high schooler to break the 4-minute mile in high school. And then he went on to coach at Manhattan College and brought small little Manhattan College to a national championship back in the 70s, which was, you know, a big deal. It was unheard of that a college that small. But he was a real pepper pot of a coach. But again, he was a tough dad. But anyway, so in high school is when, like I said, I started to rebel against the way that I was raised, you know, upper middle class. And, you know, I kind of wanted to love everybody. I didn't want to be judgmental. And I could tell that my parents wanted me to hang out with kids that were, you know, on a similar path. I mean, going to college was not even an option. We all knew we were going to college growing up. And so anyway, let's fast forward to college. Let me tell you about my first drunk. How about that, since we're at an AA convention? I was actually 14 years old, and I went to the movies with my 18-year-old cousin. And it was the original Star Wars. And my cousin bought a bottle of rum into the movie theater. And so we just got Cokes, and they kept, you know, dumping rum in my Coke. And let me tell you, what an appropriate movie to have your first drunk to. I mean, because back in the day, we had never seen anything like that. I mean, it was like, it literally took me to galaxies that I had never been to before. I was right there next to Han Solo on that Millennium Falcon, I think was the name of it. You know, flying like woo from galaxy to galaxy, and you know, and I remember when getting that feeling. Like, was it the movie or was it the alcohol? I didn't know, but I just kept dumping more and more rum in that thing, and it kept getting more and more intense. And oh, what a great feeling that was. And until on the drive home when I threw up all over my cousin's friend's brand new car. But then, and I remember I got so sick, because honestly I probably drank like a half a bottle of rum. You know, for a 14-year-old kid, first drunk, I mean, I was sick as a dog. So I remember thinking like, you know, that was cool, but that was not worth the aftermath. And really, and then I didn't drink again until I went to college. But I went to Manhattan College in New York City, and it was literally like the sheltered glass house Catholic schoolgirl getting let loose in the biggest, baddest city in the world. And let me tell you, I tore that city up. And it was a Catholic college, and so most of my friends that went to school with me also went to private high schools. It was predominantly Irish and Italian. And I figured, you know, like, well, they were all raised the same way that I was, and they were all raised in hell. So, I mean, it must just be a normal passage of, you know, rite of passage to get wasted all the time in college. And my freshman year, I remember I put on 25 pounds my first semester. And it definitely was not the food. And, I mean, it was crazy. It was on. I went out every single night. The subway station was the last stop on the one train, so I had access 24/7 to New York City. And believe me, I tore that city up. Now, remember, this was the 1980s. New York City in the 1980s, I think, epitomizes excess. I mean, it was everything all the time. I mean, you know, I loved the social aspect of it just as much as I loved the party aspect of it. I was the quintessential party girl. I hung out, you know, at places like Studio 54, Danceteria, the Peppermint Lounge. I actually hung out with, you know, some pretty famous people in New York that were partying all the time at that time, too. And, I tore that city up. I, you know, it was some of the best times of my life. You know, I love it when my friends in AA are like, Jane, you think you were having a good time. It's like, no, I was having a really good time. I was having a really good time. And I remember, also how, what I would do is I would jam during midterms and I would jam at finals, and somehow I did it. You know, my grades didn't, you know, deteriorate as a result of my partying. I was like a master manipulator. I knew exactly, you know, how to do it and get by. I was, I was a functional party girl at this point. So then I guess it was sophomore year, some outside issues started entering the scene. And the way I like to talk about outside issues is, you know, I firmly believe in singleness of purpose, and alcohol, beyond a shadow of a doubt, was my love. But it was alcohol that led me to the outside things, and it was mainly marijuana and cocaine. And I really believe that alcoholism, addiction, is a disease of the brain that translates into abnormal behaviors. And we all know what those abnormal behaviors are, right? Like driving drunk, like, waking up next to a stranger, writing bad checks, doing things that we would never do when we were in sound mind and judgment. But for me, it led to doing drugs. And pot for me was like, it enhanced my drinking experience. You know, and cocaine for me led me to drink harder and longer and faster, and I became talkative and I was dancing and having fun. I mean, so, and it saved me from so many blackouts. That's the way that I like to look at it. So anyway, and I also believe in honesty. This is an honest program, and to not talk about that would be like a lie of omission, you know, because they also played a big part in my demise. So anyway, college, junior year, I was tired, man. I was tired, and I got an opportunity to go over because I was an English literature major, but I also was majoring in French. So I got the opportunity to go over to Europe, and I remember thinking, you know, okay, when I go there, it's going to be my first geographic change. You know, I'm going to go with a clean slate. I'm going to start studying. I'm going to, you know, change my life. I'm going to get it together. I'm going to turn into a real student and quit all this party stuff. And we all know what happened when I got over there. It was on. It was on. I lived with a French family, and they had a 19-year-old wild French party girl living with them, too. So we went out and we tore up the little city that we lived in every night. And then after that semester, I was able to backpack through Europe. And I remember I had the year rail pass, and I had $300 to spend. So I went to Amsterdam first to load up, spent 150 of that. The second place that I went to was London, and I spent the other 150 getting my hair done. And it was back in the days, it was like kind of punk rock, new wavy stuff. I remember I had my like head shaved up one side, and it was bright pink up here with big long white shoots coming out the front. But I had it going on, let me tell you. And so anyway, I had a great time, and it was on that trip that I look back and it's like, oh my God, party people just magnetize other party people. It was like everybody that I ran into partied like addicts, drank like alcoholics. It was crazy. So anyway, what did I do? I said, okay, I'm tired of this, man. As soon as I get home, I'm going to clean up my act and, you know, you have a really great last year of college. Well, I got back to New York and things just got, we know the story, it got worse. I remember my senior year of college, I was dating the biggest coke dealer on campus. We, were still going down and drinking and partying in the city every night. And somehow I graduated and I had really good grades and I lucked out and I got a job teaching high school right after college, because I also majored in secondary education. So I taught high school English and French. And I'll tell you something. And I moved to a city called Hoboken, New Jersey, which is right across the river from, you know, the city that I loved. So I was like, okay, I'm safe. I'm in Hoboken, but I still had access to New York City whenever I wanted to go there. And again, I look back and I marvel. I don't know how I did what I did, how I taught high school every day. Because I was still going out every night. And I think it was instilled in me with this work ethic that my dad, you know, gave all of us. Like, okay, whatever, do what you have to do. Work, you know, play hard, but by golly, show up for work. And there were nights where I'd be up all night, go home and shower and go to work. You know, I honestly have no idea where I mustered up all that energy. Well, sometimes I knew where I mustered up all that energy, but anyway. So, you get the picture. Let me just fast forward through the party stuff. So then I guess I was about 20, and I taught high school, and that's when things started to, my last year of high school is when things, I started to get caught. You know, I started to get a little sloppy. And I was like, you know, I got to get out of here. And even throughout my life, I had like certain boundaries that I said I would never, ever cross. And slowly but surely, I started crossing all of those boundaries. You know, one of them was I had an affair with a married man. But I would never do that. But there were, you know, of course, I was thinking God will understand this and, you know, this is something that, like, the theme of my story was, like, I want to do all these wild and crazy things, get it all out of my system, but really what I want to do is get married and have a great family and live a normal life with the house with the white picket fence kind of thing. So it was almost like it was this mad rush to just get everything out of my system. And then after 3 years of teaching high school, I was tired of Hoboken, I was tired of New York City. A friend of mine had just gotten back from teaching in Japan for a couple of years, and he's like, Jane, you should go over and, you know, teach in Japan. It was in the 80s, and Japan was booming, and there was a big need for English teachers over there. And so I went on an interview, and I remember I got interviewed in New York by an English guy who was from Tokyo. And I remember we had the interview, and then I was like, have you seen New York City? He's like, no, I've been holed up in this interview, you know, interviewing in the hotel room this whole time. And I was like, well, let's go out. So we went out, and we partied, and you know what happened, and I got the job. So anyway, all of a sudden, 2 weeks later, I'm on a plane to Japan. Everyone's like, Jane, really? And do you speak any Japanese? And I was like, yeah, I know domo arigato, Mr. Roboto, that's about it. But so off I went. And again, I said to myself, you know, I heard all these things about Japan, like there's no drugs over there. If you get caught with a joint, you're going to prison for like 7 years. And I was like, that'll be good for me. So I went over and, oh my God, let me tell you, I walked into like Party Central over there because all my friends were crazy Canadians, Brits, Irish people, you know, I mean, a lot of crazy, I'll tell you who's crazy, those Australians are crazy, New Zealanders, and all we did was just, I mean, and we were let loose in Japan, and they had a word for us called henna gaijin, which means crazy aliens, and again, it was just one big party, you know. Isn't it funny how that happens to us? We make these changes with good intentions, and then we just, hey, wherever we go with us, we go with us, right? So anyway, I taught for Time Life Educational Services, and they actually contracted teachers out to big companies. So I actually worked most of the time for Toyota, and I lived in a city called Nagoya, which was sort of Toyota City. And I would get sent for a month to live in a training center with Japanese managers who were about to get sent overseas. So every morning I had to have breakfast with them, lunch with them, dinner with them, and every night drink with them. So it was almost like it was fueled all over again, you know. And, you know, of course with the drinking there were some pretty good cultural exchanges going on, but you know, it was, again, these Japanese men, most of them, lived this really hardcore, regimented work life. So when they got sent on this training, it was like, woo, you know, like, let's have fun. And, you know, pretty soon we're getting sent overseas. We're going to have to work our butts off. Let's use this time to have a great time. And I, of course, was right in the middle of it. And so I did that for 3 years. I'll tell you, you know, sometimes to throw a funny story or whatever, and you're supposed to do that when you're telling your story, but I remember one night, it was Old People Respect Day. So I went over to this Japanese friend's house, and he loved, somehow Japanese men love, like, American cowboy movies. So he, like, went down the basement, put on his cowboy hat, came up with his cowboy boots and a couple of bottles of whiskey of Kentucky and Kentucky bourbon. And so we got so drunk, him and his family. And I remember getting on the subway going home that night. And I remember I must have gotten woken up by the little Japanese conductor, like, sumimasen, sumimasen, from one end of the line to the other end of the line to the other end of the line to the other end of the line. And he kept, you know, waking me up because I kept falling asleep. And finally, I stumbled off the train. I hardly remember any of this. And the next thing I knew, I woke up in a police station. And, you know, the cops were, I was freaking out. The cops were all around me, you know, speaking Japanese. And I was just like, I just kept saying, where's my bag? Where's my bag? My bag was missing. And I had something in my bag that I shouldn't have had in there. So I was freaking out. And then I just, you know, I remember running out of the police station, hopping into a cab, and, you know, and then I realized, what am I doing? I don't have any money to pay this cab driver. I don't have my keys to get into my apartment. So at a red light, I bolted out of the cab, and I went and I slept. I spent the night in, like, a Japanese shrine, right? So I remember waking up in the morning like, oh, my God, what am I going to do? I have to go to work. I went, and I was working at Toyota, and my students were like, oh, Jane, did you have a nice weekend? And I was like, well, I had something happen. I don't remember what, I really don't remember, but I lost my bag. And they were like, oh, that's too bad. Well, at lunchtime, one of my students was reading the newspaper, and he's like, Jane, look! And I go look in the newspaper, and there's a picture of, like, a cartoon picture of, like, this foreign woman running and police officers running after them. And sure enough, it was me, and it said, you know, Sunday, it was found there was a foreign woman sleeping in the road. And you know, and we Japanese police have to learn how to speak English better because nobody knew how to deal with this woman. So I was like, oh my God, you know, but anyway, they called and somehow I got my bag back and it all ended up okay. But that was just one of many, you know, crazy, crazy stories in Japan. It was like, you know, we all just were, you know, just in that party stage of our lives. So anyway, after 3 years, I decided to come home. And by this time, you know, I thought my family will have missed me, but it didn't take them too long to see that things had just gotten worse. And, you know, I was really, you know, in a bad way. And so they started to, you know, not invite me to family functions because I would always embarrass everybody and humiliate my parents especially. And even my brothers and sisters were like, Jane, man, you know, okay, we all drank crazy when we were in college. We all were nuts, but you just seem to have, you know, it's like you're off to the races. You got to calm down. You think you're going to meet a guy living the way that you're living? And I was like, whatever, you know. And I started to then make, like, my party friends, my family, and, you know. So, okay. When I got back, I just had a lot of disillusionment. I'll try and, like, fast forward to, you know, what happened. But I, you know, I continued to party and, you know, things started to get in trouble. Got my first DUI, and a friend of mine said that, why don't you come down and come live in Florida because I have a restaurant and you can waitress and you won't need a bike because I lost my license for 6 months. So I was like, sure, that sounds like a good idea. Let me get out of New York area and I'll try and stop drinking and stop partying when I make this move. Well, guess where it was? To the Florida Keys. Like, I was going to try and get sober in the Florida Keys. What the heck, right? So I moved down to the Keys, and things just got worse. I'm not even going to, you know, tell you just how bad, but really, that's where I started to experience the incomprehensible demoralizations that the book talks about. That's where I became totally alone. That's where it was not fun anymore. That's where I did things that I never thought I would do. That's where I started to, you know, again, this rebellion that I had. That's when I started hanging in the hood. That's when I became homeless. That's when, you know, I had nowhere to turn. And it was almost like, and I got another DUI while I was down there. And I shouldn't have been driving, so I was in big trouble. And that's when I just started to have not thoughts of suicide, but I didn't want to live anymore. So I thought, I'm just going to burn myself out. I'm going to go down in flames, man. I'm going to go out with a bang. And I just didn't care if I lived or died. And I think I got down to like 85 pounds. And if I even hit the side of this, you should have seen the black and blue that would appear because of, you know, malnutrition. And and that's when I was really, you know, in a bad way. I had like this weird spiritual awakening, though, in the throes of that. I remember, you know, it was the same thing a lot of us have experienced. You look in the mirror and you don't even see yourself anymore. You see like a skeleton of the person that you were. You see the light in your eye gone. You feel ashamed and dirty and just abandoned. And I was like, you know, I got to call someone. So I remember I called a cousin of mine in Fort Lauderdale, and I was like, you know, Betty, I feel like I'm going to die in a couple of days if I don't get out of here. And she very graciously invited me, you know, to stay with her. And I went up and I started to, you know, rebuild my life a little bit. Never once thought about going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I still was drinking. I still was doing stuff to get rid of the shakes. But I certainly wasn't living the life that I was living down in the Keys, which was a disgusting life. And then I got a job and I started working and I met a great guy. He was living over in Europe at the time, but he was starting like an adventure tour package company. So he was doing like ex-adventure tours through Europe. And anyway, so he would come over like once a month and do business with the company that I was working for. And one weekend he said, why don't we go down to the Keys? Because I want to check out the water sports and what's available down there. So, of course, first tiki bar we hit, boom, went in, bought drinks, and we proceeded down to Marathon. I don't know if anyone knows but Marathon, but that's like where the old 7 Mile Bridge was. And they had just filmed that movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger, True Lies. And so anyway, we decided to go drinking that night. We went to a bar, went dancing, had fun, and we took a ride down to this bridge. And what we were doing, we had a case of beer in the car and some weed, and we were gonna just, you know, hang out and watch the sun come up. We were looking for like a scenic overview point. So as I'm proceeding down that bridge, I remember looking at Max and saying, "This is pretty cool. I mean, where does this bridge go? It's just like a road. I mean, where is it gonna end?" And it was right about when I said that where I went around a little curve, and the next thing I saw was just like lightning, and heard this tremendous crash. And when I looked up, the car, the front of the car was just like an accordion. And I just remember feeling this flash of pain. And I put my hand down to my ankle, and when I felt the bones, and I picked my hand up, and it was just dripping with blood. And I was like, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, what happened? How did this happen? Where did that wall come from?" And I looked over at Max, and he was just still, looked like he hit his head. So he, you know, I thought he passed out, and he was just, you know, just the bolt of that crash was just tremendous. And thank God we had our seatbelts on, or we both would have been flying through the windshield and over the barrier into the water. And I just was like, "Oh my God!" And I remember I couldn't move. I couldn't, like, it was like my left side was paralyzed. And I just remember crying and just like, "Oh my God, Max, wake up, wake up. How are we going to get out of this? I need you, please, come to, come to." And I remember grasping his hand and shaking his hand, and, you know, and it didn't take too long for me to realize that he wasn't breathing and that he was dead. And I remember thinking, "Oh my God, how am I going to get out of this? How is anyone going to understand how this happened? Oh my God, Max's family. Oh my God, my family." I was wishing, I actually was praying that God would take me then too. Because how could I live with myself with this? Because of my irresponsibility, a precious life was abbreviated. So anyway, it seemed like hours before the rescue trucks came and the blue lights from the police car, and I just remember thinking, "Oh my God." And it took the jaws of life to get me out of the car, and I remember I was just screaming for Max, and, you know, if he was dead, why wasn't I dead too? And the next thing I knew, I got heliported to Jackson Memorial Hospital. And I don't know, it was days later that I opened my eyes, and who was standing there but my dad. And he was just looking down at me like, "Oh my God." And I remember the first thing that I said to my father when I looked up at him was like, "Dad, it didn't happen because I was drinking." You know, and I just remember that look of, "Oh my God," the resignation, like, what is it going to take, Jane? And the denial that I had, that I had any kind of problem, you know. So anyway, then what happened was, I'll just briefly give you my injuries, but I broke my neck at C1, C2. That's the same fracture that Christopher Reeve had. You know, and a third of the people that sustain that fracture are killed instantly. And a third of the people are brain damaged. And a third of the people are paralyzed. And, you know, I'm standing here before you today. You know, that's what I mean, the miracle. So anyway, all right, let me get past this. So
I had a really long, long hospital recovery. I was in the regular hospital for 5 months, and then I had to go to a physical therapy hospital for 6 months. And as you can imagine, you know, it's weird how your body responds to tragedy, but it was like I had to get through the physical stuff first, and then all of a sudden the emotional stuff just crashed down on me, you know. And I remember I just became like a shell of the woman that I once was, you know. I lost any light that I had in me. It was a horrible, horrible state of living. But I remember looking around in the rehab hospital, especially at like the older people who just had hip replacements or knee replacements, or, you know, the children that were bald from their cancer treatments. And that's when I started to, like, you know, wake up a little bit. And I was on the spinal cord injury unit. And, you know, I remember all these, you know, wonderful people in wheelchairs that were in horrible accidents, quadriplegics, paraplegics. And I was like, you know, again, look at these people, and they're smiling, you know. So that was kind of like one of my first spiritual awakenings, was the people that were around me in the hospital and the perseverance that they showed and the endurance. And I knew, you know, I had to snap out of it. And then legal stuff started happening, and I was looking at 15 years in prison because I had two previous DUIs. And now DUI manslaughter. So as soon as I was able, I told the attorney, I was like, you know, I can't plead not guilty, because of course the attorneys want you to plead not guilty. I'm like, I was guilty as hell. Because of me, there's a life that's no longer here. So let's just get. I know I'm going to prison. Let's just get on with the sentencing thing. So I ended up pleading, you know, guilty and got sentenced, and I got 5 years of prison and 10 years of probation. And thank you so much. And I'll tell you something, I needed prison. I really needed prison. Prison was for me a place where I needed to be segregated from society in order to recover. You know, prison saved my life. I always skated out of any problems I ever got into, because I was kind of cute and funny and manipulative. And I got like the two DUIs, but really I should have had like 100 of them. And I mean, you know, the fact that it all came to this terrible head. I mean, yeah, so anyway, as I said, I got sentenced to 5 years in prison, 10 years probation. I lost my license for life, and I had to do a bunch of other stuff for probation. But let me just briefly talk about prison. I met some of the most wonderful women in my life in prison, you know, and most of them were in there because of addictions. Or they were in there because they were with their man who got in trouble, and, you know, they got brought down with them too. And I really tried to be productive while I was in there, but it took me about 2 years before I really became alive again. And I started teaching, preparing women for their GEDs. I started a literacy program. I tried to be productive when I was in there. And really, I loved going to the AA meetings that people brought into prison. So if anyone does that for their prison ministry, then God bless you and thank you, because that was always the highlight of my weeks, when the outsiders would come in and bring the AA meetings into prison. I loved going to Mass. They only had Mass like once a week. And I remember after Mass, one day the priest said, who's an Irish priest, and he said, ladies, I got permission from the warden. If any of you want to do your fifth step with me, I would love to do it with you. I'm an alcoholic in recovery. And, you know, and I was like, oh man, that's perfect. Confession and a fifth step. Kill two birds with one stone. So I did, and this priest was awesome. I mean, you know,
a lot of times Catholics get a bad rap, and I'm one of those Catholics that loves being Catholic. I had the most wonderful nuns and priests growing up in elementary school and in high school, and the brothers in college were awesome. And even in my recovery, at every turn in my recovery, there was a priest or a nun there to help me out. And he doesn't mind that I share his name, but Father O'Brien was one of those priests. And he was also from New Jersey. And can you believe, like, when I was in prison, my mother could never come see me. She just couldn't bear to see her little girl in prison. My dad came, and my siblings came. But so this priest lived in Jersey and actually went to see my mother every single time he was in New Jersey. You know, I mean, that is so cool. And then there was another priest that was there for 2 years, and I remember it was Easter week, and I went to confession again, and this priest, after I finished my confession, I looked up at him, and he really did, he looked like Jesus. He was a young priest with a beard and whatever, and I told him my confession, and when I looked up, he had tears coming down his eyes, but then his like chin started trembling, and I was like, "Aw," and then I was like, "Oh," because he was mad, and he said, "You know what, Jane? I am so sick and tired of you coming in here to confession and saying the same thing every month." He's like, "Who do you think you are? You think you're above accepting God's forgiveness?" He's like, "I don't even come back to confession with me. If I could, I would pick you up and throw you against the wall and like try and slap some sense into you, but this is not the way it's done. Once you're forgiven, those sins are thrown out there into the sea of forgiveness, but you just for some reason have this sick desire to keep reeling them back in." And he's like, "So do me a favor and don't come back." And I was just like, "Oh my God," I couldn't believe it. But you know what? That was a turning point for me. That's when I knew, okay, I not only had to deal with God's forgiveness, but I had to turn it into redemption. And it hit me like a brick that day. And it was beautiful because it was during Easter week and whatever. And also some of the other nuns that helped in recovery. I don't know if any of you have ever attended a workshop with Sister B or Sister Maurice, but they're both so awesome, and they've helped me too along my journey. But anyway, getting back to prison, and I had a sponsor from before I went to prison. My first meetings that I went to were in St. Pete Beach just before I went to prison, and that group saved my life. I mean, can you imagine? I was looking at 15 years in prison, and the only time I was allowed out of the house was to go to an AA meeting or, you know, physical therapy, and these people just loved me and told me things like, "Oh my God, you know, that could have been me so many times," and I used to drive in my car with my kids in blackouts, and for some reason hearing that stuff made me feel better, you know. But and I'm still friends with those people today, 17 years later. I mean, they've stuck by me through everything. And so I started doing my step stuff in prison, and again, I had a wonderful sponsor at that time. So prison I really needed, and it was for me, it was a great experience. So, getting out of prison, you know, it was tough. When you walk around with a felony charge like mine, it's really, it follows you around sort of like a black shadow. But we all know that we have to rally and rebuild our lives into something better. And after 5 years in prison, I was ready to do that. So I got out of prison, and I ended up living in Tallahassee, Florida. Some reason, that's where I got plopped. And I tried to get my teaching certification back. And they told me, "There's no way you're going to ever teach again. You've got felony charges. No way." And I was like, "Oh God." And when I was in prison, I thought, "What can I do?" So I said, "All right, I want to like dedicate my life to love and service." And I guess I heard that in AA in prison, and it really resonated with me. So I decided to try and I was in Tallahassee. Let me go back to school and become a social worker. So I thought, what better job to carry on love and service? So I got turned down not once, not twice, but I got let in the third time. For some reason, my letter landed in the right hands. I've never hidden what happened to me. I really, truly believe in an honest program, so I was always straightforward, and I used to just look at people and say, where would any of us be without forgiveness? I really need for you to give me a second chance. And finally, I got in. And not only did I get in, but I got an assistantship scholarship. So all I had to pay for was my books, and then I had to work, you know, 10 hours a week. And let me tell you, I took that, when people gave me a chance, I took that really seriously. Like, I was not going to let these people down. So to just put all of this in a nutshell, I went back to school. I worked full-time, making $7 an hour at a hotel at the front desk, and went back to grad school full-time. I ended up graduating at the top of my class, and I started reestablishing relationships with my family, slowly but surely. You know, they didn't want to hear about any amends. They wanted to see the living amends happening. And, you know, just wonderful things just kept happening to me. I really believe, like, when you do the right thing, good things are going to start happening. And blessing upon blessing upon blessing happened. Another term of my probation, are you ready for this? I had to go, for 10 years, I had to go to an AA meeting every day. That was from the judge, right? Now, that wasn't easy to do when I was working full-time, going to school full-time, and I didn't drive. And so that's why every once in a while when people come into meetings and they're like, oh, my God, I lost my license for 6 months, and I got to go to a meeting 3 times a week. What the hell is this? You know, it's like, hey, you know, look at what you did to drink or drug. You know, you can do this. So anyway, I'm here to say, though, I went back before the judge after 5 years, and the judge told me, okay, you don't have to go 7 days a week anymore. The next 5 years, you can go 5 times a week. It's like, oh, thanks a lot. But I'm so glad she did that. And again, the speakers back there, I don't know what I would have done without speaker tape, the taper guys back there. I don't know what I would have done without speaker tapes. Because sometimes all I could do was get another person in AA to come wherever I was at and to listen to a speaker tape, and that counted as a meeting. Great things just started happening. I ended up going through a waiver with the Department of Children and Families in Florida, and they approved it, and I was able to get a job at a psychiatric hospital. I worked with the mentally ill, and I worked with people in detox, and I worked my way up to being the supervisor of that. And then just other really cool things happened. And I don't mean to toot my horn when I talk about the good stuff that happens, but I have to share it, because if there's anyone in here who's feeling, you know, defeated and like they're at a dead end, you know, I'm here to tell you, don't put a limit on your dreams. Don't ever put a limit on your dreams, and don't ever take no for an answer. Be persistent. Because, you know, if you keep at it and you keep doing the right thing, eventually it's going to happen. And that became the new theme of my life. And then after 5 years, I became the supervisor of social services for that hospital and the 8 surrounding counties. And I got a really cool award. I became the National Association of Social Workers, Social Worker of the Year. I won like an outstanding woman in the Tallahassee Community Award, and all my good works or whatever started getting recognized, and that just made me want to do better and do more. And all of a sudden, I was actually visiting my older brother in Texas, because my nephew at 14 was an addict and tried to kill himself, and we were sitting at the kitchen table. And I got a call, and it was from the dean of the College of Social Work, and he asked if I would be interested in a faculty position. I was like, oh, my God, you know, this is just unbelievable. So I was like, of course. So anyway, I've been teaching at Florida State for 5 years now, and oh, my gosh, I love my job. I am the luckiest person on the planet Earth. I have the best job. I have the best support system. I have just everything so great going in my life right now. And again, I attribute it all to my sobriety and to work in this program. You know, all of us know that until the pain gets strong enough, you know, we're just not going to change. I obviously like to prefer to glance at my past rather than to stare at it. But the big book on page 86 tells us, you know, we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. After making our review, what do? We ask God's forgiveness and we require what corrective measures should be taken. So I am so grateful for this program. I am so grateful for this non-religious path to spiritual freedom. It's a program of self-development. It's a program of mutual assistance. We can't do this without each other. You know, and as I live my life today, I know that if I stumble, the answer is just 12 steps away. And I also know that, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that, you know, my life on earth has a purpose now. It has a purpose, and that purpose really is to help others. I know one of the things that I still struggle with are resentments. I don't know, I guess maybe it's like the feisty Irish whatever in me, but I get very resentful, and that's my danger zone when I do experience those resentments. And Sister B is the one who gave me my favorite resentment prayer that I just kind of wanted to share with you right now, because I actually have a resentment going on right now, but that's okay. You know, we all know the danger of resentments. They're definitely premeditated expectations are premeditated resentments. And instead of accepting, when we accept, when we don't accept and we expect, we're usually let down, right? So anyway, serenity certainly starts when we stop expecting and we start accepting, and this is the prayer that Sister B gave me. God, help me to look with soft eyes upon all who are a part of my days. Break through the barriers of my scrutinizing views. Transform my inner landscape into a peaceful place of acceptance. Pull back my projections and my criticisms. Replace my mean measurements and my biased expectations with an openness that allows others just to be. Cleanse me of everything that clouds my perceptions and blocks the sunlight of your spirit. That always helps me so much. I feel like I've chosen to take that road to a new freedom, and I've never looked back. I do try to practice the principles in all my affairs. Of course, I'm not perfect. One of my favorite books is The Spirituality of Imperfection. You know, I'm not okay, you're not okay, and that's okay. But as long as we try to strive to continue to do the next right thing, and we do God's will, then everything's going to be okay. And I know that whenever I fall into problem areas, it's because I'm putting myself in God's role instead of accepting God's will and asking for His guidance. I know that. You know, I'm far from perfect, but I do strive to grow from my imperfections. I feel like if we follow the principles, these are some of the gifts that we get. Hope instead of desperation. Faith instead of despair. Courage instead of fear. Peace of mind instead of confusion. Self-respect instead of self-contempt. Self-confidence instead of helplessness. We gain the respect of others instead of gaining their self-contempt, their pity and their contempt, I should say. One of my favorites is we have a clean conscience instead of guilt. We have real friendships instead of loneliness. You know? And I know that whatever I keep, I share, and every time I encourage, I receive courage. I love the counterintuitive wisdoms that are involved in this program. Like, I keep what I share. Every time I encourage, I receive courage. I have to die in order to live. I love those. I also want to remember, thankfully, the work of those who have helped me, and I pray that I'll always have time to help others. And I'm one of those that certainly believes in helping others. other people in the program, but there are so many opportunities out there in the community to be of help too. Maybe it's the social worker in me, but I'm also active in, I was diagnosed with breast cancer 2 years ago, so I'm active in a Reach to Recovery program for women who have recently been diagnosed with breast cancer. It's like a telephone consultation thing. On campus, I'm involved with a group called To Write Love on Her Arms, which is a student group that that deals with students who have had suicidal ideations or attempted to commit suicide, suffer from depression, anxiety. Perhaps they're members of the LGBTQ community who are struggling to with their lifestyle, and I love working with those students. I also, just being a social worker, I love working with the homeless people. There's so many opportunities out there to be of service. And of course, the service work that's available in AA is, you know, it's very loud and clear. But what I wanted to close with was just that, each time someone comes in contact, I really feel that they have to become different and better people as a result of us radiating God's love. You know, that's one of the reasons why I love that this is a program of attraction rather than promotion. You know, I want people to have what I have. You know, I really do. And really, it's a privilege to be me. And just like each of you should realize, it is such a privilege to be who you are. You know, you're a precious child of God, and you have a purpose here. And again, don't ever give up on your dreams. You know, I hope that my story represents, you know, hope for some people. You know, when you think of it, not too many years ago, I was sitting on a prison bunk, and now I'm like a professor at a university. How does that happen? I'll tell you, it happens because you just keep doing the next right thing. And my sponsor always tells me to close with something from the Big Book, and today I'm just compelled to expound upon what I was just talking about, acceptance. You know, I can watch my serenity level rise when I discard my expectations, but then my rights try to move in, and they too can force my serenity level down. I have to discard my rights as well as my expectations by asking myself, how important is it really? How important is it compared to my serenity, my emotional sobriety? And when I place more value on my serenity and sobriety than on anything else, I can maintain them at a higher level, at least for the time being. Acceptance is the key to my relationship with God today. I never just sit and do nothing while waiting for Him to tell me what to do. Rather, I do whatever is in front of me to be done, and I leave the results up to Him, however it turns out. That's God's will for me. I must keep my magic magnifying mind on my acceptance and off my expectations, for my serenity is directly proportional to my level of acceptance. When I remember this, I can see I've never had it so good. Thank God for AA. And I want to thank God for all of you here today. Thank you. Thank you.